Frank Volpe offered up that I was dead meat, and I found the threat convincing, coming from him. While Fenton and I helped them out of the truck, Marcy opened up the beach chairs. Hank wheeled out a serving cart between two translucent piles, one disposable pre-wrapped syringes, the other 100-milliliter plastic vials. Barry Neubauer continued to glower at me as I shared some good news and some bad news. In a few minutes, you'll be able to go inside and make yourselves comfortable, but first, this man, who is a trained medical technician, is going to draw blood from each of you except for Mr. Montrose. I'm not going to explain any of this, so please don't ask. It didn't go down well. "Anyone who touches me with a needle is going to be sued," yelled Tom Fitzharding. I remembered the picture of he and his wife with Peter when my brother was 16 or 17 years old. I slapped Fitzharding across the face. It made a loud noise and shut everybody up. It felt good, too. I didn't like him or his wife, and I had good reasons. "Once this unpleasantness has been taken care of, you can go inside," I repeated. "You can shower, change, and lie down for a nap. But whether you cooperate or not, no one is going in until this is done. If it makes you feel any better, he's going to take blood from each of us, too."
"It doesn't make me feel the slightest bit better, you little snot," said Stella Fitzharding.
I leaned in close to her. "I know all about you and Peter, so shut the hell up." "I need a shower. You can start with me," offered Tricia Powell, sitting down on one of the chairs. She wearily held out her arm. After that, things went surprisingly smoothly. Hank and Marcy carefully drew and labeled 90 milliliters from everyone in the garage. Then the hostages were brought inside and led to the almost completed sports entertainment wing. Foam mattresses were lined up on the floor for them. There were bathrooms, of course. We even had coffee and rolls, and lots of organic milk. "Try and get some sleep," I advised. "It's going to be a long day." Chapter 84. Earlier in the week, Marcy had gone to the Kmart in Riverhead and rummaged through the discount tables, looking for garments to clothe our guests. When the Neubauers and Fitzhardings, Volpe, Tricia Powell, and Montrose lined up for breakfast, they were dressed, well, modestly and inexpensively. The food and sleep had improved their spirits, but their faces were marked by confusion and anxiety. Why were they here? What now? We'd given a lot of thought to security and decided to keep it simple. Every door in the wing we were using was padlocked. A few were double padlocked. Everyone was told they would be gagged and tied down for the first time they gave us any trouble, or even made us suspicious. So far, the threat had worked. It also helped that Marcy, Fenton, and Hank carried stun guns at all times. Shortly after breakfast, Macklin arrived with a petite, gray-haired woman. The group exchanged more puzzled looks and seemed buoyed by the hope that this would soon be over. Then, as Mac and I huddled in the corner, Bill Montrose appealed to my grandfather's better judgment.
"Mr. Mullen, it's very good to see you," said Montrose. "I think you realize that if we're released before anyone is hurt, those involved are likely to fare much better. I can almost promise it."
"You'd know more about that than me," said Macklin, as he turned his back on the lawyer.
Nevertheless, the seven hostages saw some reason to be hopeful, until they were walked into a vast oceanfront living room whose slate floors and redwood beams and a jaw-dropping view were the focal point of the house. This morning, however, the drapes were pulled across the entire expanse of glass. The room was lit by powerful lights that Marcy and Fenton had hung from the ceiling. Montrose muttered,
"Oh, Jesus, no."
The sparsely furnished room held a pair of long wooden tables and several chairs. Facing them from a foot-high plywood platform was a black leather office chair. Between the elevated chair and the tables were two more chairs. One held a Bible, the other fronted a small desk. On it was an archaic contraption that looked like a typewriter with a few working parts chopped off. Behind the raised chair hung two shimmering flags, the Stars and Stripes and the green, white, and gold of Ireland. In the midst of the furniture
was a rolling tripod holding a TV camera. EH-70 was stenciled on the side. Molly aimed it at our guests as they filed into the room, handcuffed and grumbling, and sat in the row of beach chairs behind the tables. Each of them looked in shock. Next, the door to the room was locked. Hank stood beside it with a stun gun and a Louisville Slugger. Then Molly spun the camera around to track Macklin as he walked the length of the room. He stepped warily onto his little stage and sat on the leather chair. At about the same time, his friend and court stenographer, Mary Stevenson, took her seat in front of the old machine. To Macklin's right, a homemade sign was being taped to the otherwise pristine white wall. Molly focused on the simple block letters. The People versus Barry Neubauer. Chapter 85. The first real disturbance came, not surprisingly, from Volpe. He stood up and yelled at the top of his voice.
This is bullshit!
Hank ran over from the door with a stun gun held out like a sword. He zapped Volpe, who dropped to the floor, writhing in pain. I thought it was a good lesson for the group to see.
Frank, keep your mouth shut, Hank yelled. That goes for the rest of you scum, too.
I think they all got the point. Without warning, Molly spun her camera again, this time to aim its merciless eye at me. I stood to my full 6'1", took a deep breath, and stared straight into the lens. Ever since the cold-blooded murder of Sammy in the East Village, I'd applied myself in ways I never could have at Nelson, Goodwin, and Mickle. I just hoped I was doing the right thing. I'd been cramming for this my whole year at Columbia, and not just by obsessing on Peter's cold-blooded murder and the injustice that followed. I had read and reread Fundamentals of Trial Techniques and The Art of Cross-Examination, a classic published in 1903 which still held up. We're on, said Molly, tapping the red light on the camera. We're broadcasting. Go, Jack. My name is Jack Mullen, I began, my voice cracking slightly and sounding as if it belonged to someone I barely knew. I was born and raised in Montauk and have lived here my whole life. No one in the room was half as uptight as I was, but I put my faith in the steady, measured cadence I'd practiced so diligently during lawyering clinics at Columbia. Everything about my tone and bearing attempted to communicate that I was sane, basically reasonable, and worth hearing out. I also knew that the time was ripe for this. I was pretty sure that a lot of people were angry and upset about what they considered courtroom injustices in the recent past. The Simpson verdict, the Diallo verdict in New York City, the botched JonBenet Ramsey case, and others in their own cities and towns. A year ago yesterday, I continued, my brother died at a party held at a Hampton beach house. He'd been hired to park cars. The next day, his body washed up on the beach below the property. The inquest held at the end of that summer concluded that my brother, who was 21, died accidentally. He didn't. He was beaten to death. In the next few hours, I will try to prove not only that he was murdered, but why and by whom. Sitting at the end of the table to my left is the man who owns the house and hosted the party. His name is Barry Neubauer. He's the CEO of Mayflower Enterprises. You've probably watched his cable channels, or visited his websites, or taken your children to one of his theme parks. Maybe you've read about his bigger-than-life exploits in a business magazine or seen a picture of him taken at a celebrity charity gala. But that doesn't mean that you know the real Barry Neubauer. You will, though. Far better than you want to, because Barry Neubauer is about to stand trial for the murder of my brother.
Jack Mullen is gonna prosecute me, shouted Neubauer. Like hell. Turn that fucking camera off. Turn it off now!
His outburst was followed by so many others that Macklin had to crack his black walnut gavel for quiet. This trial will begin in a few minutes, I said to the camera. We're broadcasting live on Channel 70. This short break will give you a chance to call your friends. Chapter 86. Molly turned the camera off and I motioned to Fenton and Hank. We walked over to Neubauer. He held up his handcuffed wrists.
Take them off.
I ignored the demand as if it came from a spoiled child. It doesn't make any difference to me whether you all participate in the trial or not, I told Barry flat out. It changes nothing. He huffed like a self-important CEO.
We're not going to cooperate. So what will that look like on TV? You'll look like a complete fuck-up, Mullen, which is what you are.
I shook my head at Neubauer. Then I took a manila envelope out of my briefcase. I showed him what was inside, and I only showed Barry. This is what it will look like, Barry. And this, and all of these, I said.
You wouldn't dare,
he snarled at me. Oh yeah, I would. As I said, it's your choice. You can offer your side of things. If you don't, that's fine too. We're going back on the air. Molly started filming again, and I repeated my introductory remarks, this time a little more calmly and cogently. Before this trial is over, I continued, you'll understand that Barry Neubauer is a killer, and that everyone sitting in these chairs contributed either to the crime or its cover-up. Once you've seen what they've done, you won't have an ounce of pity for them. Believe me, you won't. The people will show that Barry Neubauer killed my brother himself or hired someone else to do his bloody grunt work. We will also show that, along with the means and opportunity to kill Peter, he had one hell of a motive. When you hear the motive, you'll understand everything. I fully recognize these aren't ideal circumstances to determine a man's innocence or guilt, I said.
Oh, really? Said Bill Montrose. That's the first intelligent thing you've said so far, Mullen.
I ignored Montrose. I knew that the crucial thing at this point was to keep plowing ahead and not allow myself to be sidetracked. My mouth had become too dry to continue. I stopped and picked up my water glass. My hand trembled so badly, I almost dropped it. My voice was steady, though. If you bear with me, I believe you'll see that this trial is at least as fair as any you might have followed lately. Fairness is all we're looking for here. For one thing, Mr. Neubauer will have the benefit of counsel, and not an overworked, underpaid green defender like those assigned to many indigent defendants who end up on death row. He's the eminent Bill Montrose, senior partner and management committee chairman at a large New York law firm. And since Mr. Montrose is Mr. Neubauer's longtime personal attorney, and recently represented him with such success at the inquest, he's extremely well-versed in all the particulars. When you consider that Mr. Montrose's adversary will be myself, a 27-year-old barely out of law school, it is, if anything, a mismatch in the defendant's favor. Acting as judge in this courtroom will be my grandfather, Macklin Reed Mullen, I said, setting off another round of outrage from Montrose. The stenographer is Mary Stevenson, a court reporter in New York City municipal courts for 37 years. Once again, I realize this is more than a little unusual. All I can say is watch the trial. Give us a chance. Then make your own judgments. My grandfather came to this country at the age of 48 from County Clare, Ireland. He has spent the past 20 years working as a paralegal, and he cares more about the law and justice than anyone I've ever come across, including my law professors. In any criminal trial, the judge is there not to determine guilt or innocence, but to rule on differences between the lawyers regarding evidence or procedure and to keep the process intact. In this case, I said, staring intently into the camera, you will be the jury. Macklin is not here to issue a verdict, just to administer the proceedings. And he'll do a great job. That's all I have to say right now. Mr. Montrose will speak next. Chapter 87. Bill Montrose was the only one of our guests not wearing handcuffs. He sat there lost in thought. Then, like any good poker player, he turned to read my face. I did everything I could to seem oblivious to the crucial importance of the next few seconds. If he was genuinely concerned about the welfare of his client, his course would be clear. But like many highly successful, yet relatively anonymous attorneys, Montrose had reached a point in his life when he yearned for some fame and glory to stack beside his cash and real estate. I knew that much about him from my time at Nelson, Goodwin, and Mickle. According to colleagues, he'd proclaimed himself a far better trial lawyer than Johnny Cochran or Robert Shapiro. Bill Montrose had the largest ego of anyone I had ever met. I was counting on it. I sucked in a breath as Montrose stood. He faced Molly's East Hampton Channel 70 camera. This was his big moment, too. He wasn't about to sit it out.
"Please don't misunderstand or misinterpret," he began. "Just because I'm standing in front of you for the moment doesn't mean that this proceeding has a shred of legitimacy. It doesn't. Make no mistake," he continued after a dramatic pause, "this is not a trial. This is not a courtroom. The elderly man behind me, no matter how spry and avuncular, is not a judge. This is a kangaroo court. You should know that justice has already been served in this case. Last summer, an inquest was convened to look into the drowning death of Peter Mullen in a real courtroom presided over by a real judge, the Honorable Robert P. Lillian. My client was found to be blameless. During that inquest, the court heard a witness who saw the deceased dive into a dangerous ocean at high tide late in the night. Not one, but two medical examiners presented evidence to support their conviction that there had been no foul play. After weighing the testimony, Judge Lillian, in a decision available to anyone who wants to take the time to read it, concluded that Peter Mullen's death, however sad, was no one's fault but his own. Apparently, his family is unable to accept this. By taking this unfortunate action, Peter Mullen's brother and grandfather are turning an accident into a crime." Once again, Montrose paused as if to gather his thoughts. I had to admit, the guy was very good. Maybe this was a mismatch. "Now they're asking you to watch. Please don't. Turn off the set or turn the dial. Do it right now. Do it if you believe in justice. I trust that you do." Montrose sat down, and I wondered if we would ever get him to speak again. Macklin tapped his gavel on the plywood platform below his chair.
"This court," he said, "will recess for 90 minutes to allow the prosecution and defense to ready their cases. I suggest you both get busy."
Chapter 88. 14 minutes into the recess, ABC interrupted its coverage of the LA Open from Riviera Country Club and cut to Peter Jennings in the Lincoln Center studio of World News Tonight. A bold, superstated breaking news.
"ABC News has just learned," said Jennings with the most discreet warble in his deep voice, "that media billionaire Barry Neubauer, his wife, and at least three guests were abducted last night following a Memorial Day party at their Amagansett, Long Island summer home. According to a transmission just broadcast live on East Hampton Channel 70, the abductors plan to try Neubauer for the murder of a 21-year-old resident of Montauk. The trial, at an undisclosed location, is set to begin in less than an hour."
As Jennings continued in his clipped Canadian accent, a red square appeared in the upper right-hand corner of the screen. It showed a simple outline of the end of Long Island, and in bold red type, "Crisis in the Hamptons." Within minutes, the anchors or substitute anchors for both CBS, "The Siege of Long Island," and NBC, "Hostages in the Hamptons," had tightened their ties and joined the fray. Like Jennings, they would spend the next 45 minutes authoritatively treading water as their reporters scrambled to catch up with the breaking story. ABC's first remote was an interview with Sergeant Tommy Harrison in the parking lot behind the East Hampton police station.
"Jack and Macklin Mullen," said Harrison, "are well-known longtime residents of Montauk, who seem to have acted out of frustration about the outcome of an inquest into Peter Mullen's death last summer."
"Do either have a criminal record?"
asked the reporter.
You don't get it, said Harrison. Except for one minor incident that Jack Mullen was involved in after his brother died, neither has ever been arrested. Not even a speeding ticket.
ABC then cut to the Justice Department in Washington for a live briefing that had just begun.
Of the hostages seized in Long Island last night, the five who have been identified are Barry and Campion Neubauer, Tom and Stella Fitzharding, who own a home in Southampton, and William Montrose, a prominent New York attorney.
When the spokesman looked up from his notes, he was peppered with discordant queries. Why were the hostages taken? Why can't you track the source of the broadcast? What do you know about the kidnappers? He made just one more short statement, then brought the briefing to a close.
The abductors are employing a scrambling device that so far has prevented us from pinpointing the source of the broadcast. To say any more at this point would be counter to our efforts to resolve this situation as quickly as possible.
Then ABC cut away again to the offices of Channel 70 in Waynescott. The 24-year-old station manager, J.J. Hart, stood beside the station's lawyer, Joshua Epstein. Hart stated that he had no intention of complying with the government's gag order. Our reporter, Molly Ferrer, has pulled off one of the greatest scoops in television journalism. We have no intention of not sharing it with the public.
The injunction is blatantly unconstitutional, said Epstein. Monday, I'm going to have it thrown out of court. Unless something happened last night that no one's told me about, we still live in a democracy.
To summarize what we know so far, said Jennings, we have five hostages and maybe more. The grandfather and grandson kidnappers were apparently unhinged by the controversial death of a family member, and a most unusual murder trial is about to begin. We will have more soon, but right now we're going to go back to our affiliate, Channel 70 in East Hampton, where the live broadcast of the murder trial is about to start.
Chapter 89. The People's Court of Montauk, said Macklin in a calm and assured voice. Obliged to nothing but the truth, and having zero tolerance for bullshit, is called to order.
Then he brought his gavel down with a resounding smack. My grandfather and I acknowledged the sweet significance of the moment by exchanging a quick glance before I called Tricia Powell to the stand. I think she understood the significance of appearing on TV, but maybe not what was about to happen to her. Once she had been sworn in, I began. Miss Powell, I understand you arrived at this season's party in style.
I guess you mean my new Mercedes.
It's been quite a turn of events, hasn't it? One summer you're an executive assistant at Mayflower. The next you're stepping out of a $45,000 sedan.
I've had a good year, said Tricia Powell with some indignation. In February, I was promoted to director of special events.
Forgive me for prying, but what were you making last year?
$39,000.
And now?
$90,000, she said proudly.
So months after you lied at the inquest about seeing my brother dive out into deadly cold waves at Neubauer's party, you're promoted and your salary more than doubles. Perjury served you better than a Harvard MBA.
Your Honor, barked Montrose.
Sustained, said Macklin. Knock it off, Jack.
Excuse me. Months after you testified that you saw my brother dive into 50-degree water in the middle of his shift parking cars, your salary increased by $51,000. Is there anything other than your testimony that made you so much more valuable to your employer?
There is, but you wouldn't want to hear about it, said Powell. After all, it doesn't fit in with your conspiracy theories.
Please, Miss Powell, give me a chance. The court wants to hear your version of things.
I worked 50 and 60-hour weeks. There was no way I was going to stay an assistant for long.
I believe that's correct, I said, opening the manila folder I held in my hand.
Miss Powell, I'm showing you what has been marked People's Exhibit A. I handed her the document. Do you recognize it?
Yes.
What do you recognize it to be?
That's my 6-month evaluation at Mayflower Enterprises.
How did you get it? She demanded. That's not relevant just now, I said. Do you recognize the signature at the bottom of the last page? I said, pointing to her signature.
It's mine.
Your Honor, I said, looking up at Mac, at this time, the people offer People's Exhibit A in evidence. Mac turned to Montrose.
Any objection? I object to these entire proceedings, said Montrose. Overruled, snapped Mac. People's Exhibit A is admitted. Go ahead, Jack.
I'm going to skip right past the opening section that documents the days you managed to be late or sick, and read from the section titled Conclusion, Next Steps. I think it should give us all a fair idea of the impression you were making on your employer before my brother died. Here's the final paragraph, I said. Asked to rate her performance from 0 to 10 in attitude, effort, and overall competence, her 3 supervisors gave her no score higher than a 6. Miss Powell has been given a written warning. If her work doesn't improve dramatically in the next few months, she will be terminated.
Well, I guess I made dramatic improvement, said Tricia Powell.
Chapter 90. Bill Montrose was out of his seat in a flash. With his shock of white hair, sturdy body, and abrupt, confident movements, he looked a little like a maestro at Lincoln Center. He stood very still at the front of the room. He evoked the concentration of a conductor waiting for his orchestra to settle down.
Miss Powell, he asked when he emerged from his spell, were you compensated in any way for your testimony at the inquest last summer?
Absolutely not, said Powell. Not a penny.
Were you promised anything by Barry Neubauer or anyone else acting on his behalf?
No.
Was a promotion, a raise, a window office, a personal trainer, or even a new pair of shoes dangled in front of you?
No, said Powell, even more indignantly.
Miss Powell, Jack Mullen seems to be under the delusion that there's something scandalous about an ambitious and talented person coming to the attention of the CEO. There isn't. You've done nothing to feel the slightest bit apologetic about.
Thank you.
I rose from my seat. Does Mr. Montrose have a question?
I certainly do. Miss Powell, let me ask you how it is that you came to be in this courtroom this afternoon. You're not here voluntarily.
Of course not, said Tricia. None of us are.
Could you tell us how you got here?
I was driving home, said Powell, when a man sprung up from my back seat. He threatened me.
Were you afraid?
Wouldn't you be? I almost drove off the road.
Then what?
He directed me to a house where I was forced into the back of a smelly milk truck with the Fitzhardings.
How long were you in the truck?
Almost 7 hours.
And are you free to leave now?
Montrose asked.
No.
If Mr. Mullen will allow it, Miss Powell, you may return to your seat.
Thank you.
After Tricia Powell retreated, Montrose turned to face the camera. He was about to make a speech when a look of alarm swept over his face. His jaw actually dropped.
Chapter 91. Montrose's anxious eyes followed Jane Davis as she strode across the stone floor, her footsteps echoing in the room. Jane wore black dress slacks and a black blouse, and she didn't appear nervous or afraid as she had at the inquest. She stared at Montrose, then turned to look directly at Barry Neubauer. To show his lack of concern, Neubauer flashed a smug smile. To show hers, she smiled back serenely.
"The people call Dr. Jane Davis," I announced, and she walked to where Fenton was waiting with his family's Gideon Bible. In contrast to the inquest, where her hands had trembled, she seemed perfectly calm. She placed a hand on the Bible's red leatherette cover and swore to tell the truth. "Dr. Davis," I said as she was seated, "we appreciate the potential consequences of your testifying today. We're grateful." "I want to be here," she said. "No one has to thank me." Then she leaned back and took a deep, calming breath. "Dr. Davis," I began, "could you please review your education for the court?" "Certainly. I graduated first in my class from East Hampton High School in 1986 and was a National Merit Scholar. I believe I was the first person in over a decade to be admitted to Harvard from East Hampton High, but couldn't afford the tuition, so I went to SUNY Bingham.
Have you had any graduate education?"
"Yes. Yes, I attended Harvard Medical School, then did internships at UCLA Hospital in Los Angeles and at Cornell Medical Center, New York Hospital in New York City."
"How are you presently employed?"
"For the past 2 years, I have been chief pathologist at Huntington Hospital and also the medical examiner for Suffolk County."
"Your Honor," I said, looking up at Mac, "the people offer Dr. Jane Davis as an expert witness in pathology and forensic medicine."
Mac turned to Montrose, who was still in a state of agitation.
"I'm sure Mr. Montrose has no objection to Dr. Davis's testimony, as he called her as an expert witness before the inquest. Correct, Counselor?"
Montrose nodded distractedly and mumbled no objection.
"Dr. Davis," I began, "you performed the autopsy on my brother?"
"Yes."
"Dr. Davis, before you came into the courtroom, Miss Powell described her abduction before the start of this trial. I was hoping you could share your own experience before the inquest."
She nodded.
"The night before I was to testify," she said, "a man broke into my home. I was in bed asleep. He woke me and put a gun between my legs. He said he was concerned about my testimony going well. He had been sent to coach me. He said if I blew any lines at the inquest, he would come back and rape and murder me."
For the first time since she'd entered the room, Jane lowered her head and stared at the floor.
"I'm sorry you had to go through that, Jane," I said.
"I know."
"What did you do in court the next day?" I asked. "At the inquest?"
"I committed perjury,"
said Jane Davis, loud and clear.
She continued, "In the course of completing your brother's autopsy, I took 26 x-rays. I performed half a dozen biopsies and did extensive blood and lab work. Peter had 19 broken bones, including both arms and both wrists, 8 fingers and 6 ribs. His skull was fractured in 2 places and he had 3 cracked vertebrae. In several cases, the welts on his body showed such perfect fist and footprints, they looked like they had been traced on. On top of that, Peter's lung tissue was not consistent with drowning. The level of saturation was in keeping with someone who was dumped into the water after he'd stopped breathing. The evidence that Peter had been kicked and beaten to death, then dragged into the water was overwhelming. That Peter Mullen was murdered is as irrefutable as that I'm sitting here right now."
Chapter 92. Montrose rose from his chair. The enormous strain was evident by the set of his jaw. I could almost hear him reminding himself that he was the great Bill Montrose.
"Is there such a thing as a fair trial that isn't quite fair?" he asked. "Of course not, but our abductors would have you believe otherwise. I know it's not exactly accepted legal procedure," Mr. Mullen suggests, with his apologetic shrug, "for defenders to be dragged at gunpoint out of their cars in the middle of the night. But give us a chance. We're just ordinary people like you. We've been driven to this because the system is broken. The system is unfair."
But that's not how justice works. Certainly not how it's supposed to work according to the Constitution and the laws of our country.
Montrose flinched, as if he felt a threat to the Constitution as keenly as a physical blow.
Justice, he continued, is not about being slightly fairer than your expectations. It's about being fair, period. And how can there be a fair trial when the prosecution can ambush the defense with a surprise witness like Jane Davis?
I had heard more than enough of Montrose's rhetoric. If Macklin was going to allow speeches, I was going to give one of my own.
Everyone in this room understands your frustration, I said, rising from my chair. We were in the courtroom last summer when Dr. Davis, after being terrorized all night, said she believed my brother's death was accidental. Just like you, the young prosecutor, Nadia Elper, was so taken aback she wasn't prepared to cross-examine. But although the tactics you're facing today are almost identical to the ones she faced, there's a fundamental difference, I said, feeling my face redden. At the inquest, the prosecutor was ambushed by a lie. You've been ambushed by the truth, a truth which you've probably known all along. You love to go on about what a mockery this trial is, Mr. Montrose. What really galls you is that it's almost fair. After tirelessly defending the rich and powerful for 25 years, you've become so warped that anything even resembling a level playing field is offensive. I suggest you get over it.
All right. That's enough, Mac finally said from his chair. This court is adjourned for the evening.
Chapter 93. This time, when The People vs. Barry Neubauer adjourned, the newsmaking machinery was stoked and ready to crank. The siege on Long Island was the most ratings-friendly story in years, and it was convenient. Half the reporters and producers who filed stories that evening were already in the Hamptons when the day began. The instant Channel 70 went black, the dueling anchors began addressing the nation. They rolled out the profiles their networks had thrown together in the past 2 hours. The country learned how Barry Neubauer had married into one of the East Coast's most prominent publishing families and extended its reach into radio and cable, theme parks and the internet. They heard respectful assessments of his vision from rivals like Ted Turner and Rupert Murdoch. They also learned that his Yale-educated lawyer, William Montrose, hadn't lost a case in 17 years. Montrose had cemented his reputation in a Fort Worth courtroom 9 years before with his defense of a wealthy rancher who'd killed a tennis pro he'd wrongly suspected of sleeping with his mistress. Colleagues said Montrose so outlawed the prosecutor that the state, which had pushed hard for second-degree murder, was grateful to get a $1,000 fine for possession of an unregistered firearm. Then came the deluge about the Mullins. Interviews with prominent townspeople touched on the death of Jack's mother and father and revealed how little the pair conformed to a terrorist profile.
The only reason I'm the mayor of Montauk, said Peter Siegel, is that Macklin didn't run, and Jack is our homegrown golden boy.
They're the working-class Kennedys of Montauk, pronounced Edward Mahoney, who'd arrived in town on assignment for Vanity Fair.
The same good looks and charisma, the same Irish Catholic blarney, and the same tragic curse.
The reporting showed how quickly the story had polarized the East End. When a sunburned investment banker getting out of his Porsche in front of an East Hampton wine shop was approached by a reporter, he said, "I hope they get life." He was expressing the prevailing sentiment of the Uber class. The locals saw it differently. They may have couched it in neutral-seeming soundbites like, "I just hope everyone gets home safe," but the only ones whose safety they were concerned about were the Mullins and their friends.
"If you know what's happened to this family in the past few years," said Denise Lowe, a waitress at PJ's Pancake House, "you'd understand that this is an American tragedy. It's just so sad. We all love Jack and Macklin."
But it wasn't until nearly midnight, when the newsreaders went home and the cable pundits took over, that the truly sympathetic editorial commentates began to seep out. As has often been the case, the voice ahead of the curve belonged to Geraldo. That night, he broadcast from the bar of the Shagwong restaurant, moderating the show like a town meeting. Geraldo drew out the locals. He encouraged them to gush and reminisce about Mac and Jack.
"One reason that Macklin might be so comfortable in this new role," said Gary Miller, who owned a nursery, "is that unofficially he's been the town judge for 20 years. As a matter of fact, we're sitting in his favorite court right now."
Geraldo also set up a live remote with Chauncey Howells, dean of Columbia Law School.
"Jack Mullen was not a good law student. He was a brilliant law student," said Howells. "One of the sharpest I've ever taught. Nevertheless, he didn't apply for a single legal job. Well, that suggests to me he was planning this for some time and appreciated the consequences. I have no doubt that, for Jack Mullen, this was a moral and ethical and well-considered decision."
"Make no mistake," said Geraldo in closing, "Jack and Macklin Mullen are not fanatics or radicals or even nutjobs. They are people who, not unlike you and me, were fed up by the transparent inequities of the criminal justice system. The only difference is that those injustices hit a lot closer to home for them than for us. They decided to do something about it. Our prayers go out to everyone caught up in this tragedy. Good night, my friends."
And as the networks and cable stations turned The People versus Barry Neubauer into more grist for the mill, the FBI poured into the Hamptons. In their styleless, rubber-soled brogans, bad haircuts, and generic domestic sedans, they looked as out of place as someone on food stamps.
Chapter 94. "If I'm not real careful, I could get used to a place like this," said Macklin, running one long bony finger along the aged mahogany wainscoting that made the room seem as if it had been lifted from a stone manse in some British PBS miniseries. We were sitting in the corner library, just off the more austere space we'd turned into our courtroom. Mac and I had parked ourselves on the polished oak floors and sat facing the long, tall window that looked out on the empty beach. It felt as if I'd just lived through the world's first 100-hour day. "I've been thinking about Marcy and Fenton and Hank," I said. "We shouldn't have let them get involved."
"It's a little late for that, Jack. Besides, they wanted to be here," said Macklin impatiently. "And I hope you've more in your hand than you showed today."
"How about Jane's testimony?" I asked him.
"It was the best you had, but it didn't implicate Neubauer. Not in the least. Where's the hard evidence, Jack?"
"You can't skip steps, Mac," I told him. As Fenning, my old trial tactics instructor, put it, "you gotta build the boat."
"Well, build the friggin' thing already and make sure it floats. Now help me up, Jack. I've got to get into my sleeping bag. I shouldn't be talking to you anyway."
I grabbed a huge, gnarled hand and pulled hard. While I had him there, I gave him a long, stout hug. I felt I was grabbing a bag of bones. "Don't get old of me, Mac," I said. "I need you too much."
"I feel like I've aged 10 years in the last 10 hours. That's not too good when you start the day at 87.
Chapter 95. The library had its own balcony, and once Mac hobbled off, I slid the glass door open and stepped outside. I knew I shouldn't have been out there, but I needed to clear my head. I wanted to think everything through one more time, especially the main reason why I hoped we might actually get away with this. The deck was angled out from the corner of the house. Whether you looked east toward the lighthouse or west toward town, you didn't see another man-made structure. In its vast, cold-blooded beauty, a Montauk night can make you feel as significant as a fly jammed up on the wrong side of a windowsill. But tonight,
That dwarfing scale was comforting, and the stars were dazzling. One of the many happy side effects of perspective and clear thinking is that it helps you sleep. I stretched out on the cedar planks, and in seconds I was out. I was jarred from sleep by footsteps at the end of the deck. It was too late to run. I sat up and stared blindly into the dark. Maybe the FBI, some deep, scary voice about to order me to roll over on my stomach and put my hands behind my back. We had made it clear, I'd hoped, that we weren't going to harm any hostages. There was no need to shoot me on sight. I almost said out loud, no need to shoot. I smelled Pauline's light perfume before I saw her. Coming back here was insane, I said, when she stepped out of the darkness. But I didn't say it with much conviction. I figured she'd been thinking the same thing I had, that this might be our last night together for a long time. So, I'm insane, she said. Well, you've come to the right place. She lay down and leaned into me, and for a few minutes, I forgot about everything except how right she is for me. The thought filled me with anguish. I didn't mean it, Polly girl. I'm really glad you came back from New York. I know, Jack. So give the girl a kiss. Chapter 96. An hour or so later, Pauline and I were still on the deck beneath the canopy of 1,000 glittering stars. Did you get the blood work back from Jane? She asked softly. For a second, I was somewhere so far away that I didn't know what she meant. Not till tomorrow. Early, I hope. How about you? How'd it go out there in the big bad world? I did good, said Pauline with her loveliest cat-ate-the-canary grin. Real good, Jack. You're going to be happy. How many could you track down? 12, she said. Out of 12. And how many signed? All of them. Every single one, Jack. They hate the son of a bitch Neubauer as much as we do. Looks like I hired the right investigator, I said and kissed her again. You have an eye for talent. Oh, by the way, Jack, you're famous.
Good famous or bad famous?
Depends on the channel and the commentator. The guy on Hardball says you and Mac should be dragged into the town square and hung.
It would make powerful television.
10 minutes later, Geraldo compared you to heroes in the American Revolution.
I always felt Geraldo never got the respect he deserves.
Since when?
Since tonight.
And this weatherwoman on Fox, I think she wants to have your baby.
Someone should tell her I'm taken.
Good answer, Jack. You're learning.
It's true.
If there's any baby-making involving me, it's going to be done with a non-weather woman with the musical name of Pauline Grabowski. There was a sweet pause. Pauline?
What's that, lawyer boy?
I love you. I love you too. That's why I'm here, she whispered. It's probably why we're all here, Jack.
I love you more than I ever thought I could love anybody. I worship you, actually.
You surprise me, in good ways, just about every day we're together. I love your spirit, your compassion, that sweet, funny laugh of yours. I never get tired of being with you. I miss you terribly when you're away.
I stopped and looked into her eyes. Pauline stared back, didn't blink.
Will you marry me?
I whispered. This time the silence was frightening. I was afraid to move.
I finally propped myself on one elbow and leaned over her. Her face seemed to be broken into a million shimmering pieces. She looked more beautiful than I had ever seen her. When she nodded through her tears, the riddle of my life was solved.
Chapter 97.
29-year-old Coast Guard Lieutenant Christopher Ames sat tall behind the tapered windscreen of his jet-powered Black Hawk 7000 helicopter and felt as if the night were his own private video game. He was on duty searching for the missing millionaires, but his heart wasn't in it. He didn't much like any of the millionaires he'd met, all three of them. 18 miles northeast of Montauk was Block Island. Ames had spent the day flying back and forth over every square inch. Zilch. He wasn't really surprised. Now he was racing back to Long Island, hot-dogging it slightly, but nothing to get court-martialed for. He took a glance at the speed indicator. 280. Hell, it felt twice that. He was flying less than 50 feet above the cement-hard whitecaps. At the Montauk Lighthouse, Ames juked left and followed the steep, jagged coastline. In the moonlight, it seemed to be crumbling into the surf. He figured he'd ride the cliffs for a few miles before tacking inland to MacArthur Airport. That's when he spotted the dark, low-slung mansion in the dunes. He'd been scoping out multi-million-dollar vacation homes all day, but this one was over the top, even by the lofty standards of waterfront real estate in these parts. Sleek and serpentine, it went on forever along the cliffs. Still, on the first big weekend of the summer, there wasn't a single light on. Strange. And a goddamn waste. Somebody ought to be using this spread. He pulled on the stick hard, and the big bird seemed to screech to a stop in midair. It made him think of a cartoon character who realizes a beat too late that he's just run off the side of a cliff. Then, for the umpteenth time that day, Lieutenant Ames banked toward another mansion. In close, he could see that the place wasn't quite finished. He spun around the grassless site like a stock car, circling a quarter-mile track. His turbine engine hacked up a dirt cyclone that would settle over everything in its path, from the front porch to the big yellow steamroller at the end of the driveway. He was about to swerve back and head for the airport when he noticed the mountain bike leaning up against one of the few trees. He hit it with his 8,000-watt spotlight and saw a lock hanging open from a back tire. What have we here? More slowly now, he circled the place again. He hovered at roof height and beamed his lights along the row of blacked-out windows. That's when he saw the couple literally under his nose on the deck, both of them buck naked. Ames was about to search for the two-way radio when the woman stood up and turned to face the lights. She was beautiful and not in a pouting model sort of way. For about 10 seconds, she stood with her hands on her hips and stared up as if she was trying to tell him something important with her eyes. Then she raised both hands to her shoulders and flipped in the bird with each one. Ames started to laugh, and for the first time all day remembered why he liked America. I must have something better to do, he thought, than bust a couple of trespassers for making love in one of the most beautiful spots in North America. He put the handset back on his cradle, then swung the big bird back toward MacArthur Airport. He was still smiling about the pretty girl who had flipped him the double bird. Chapter 98. Pauline and I were lost in our own little world, holding hands and watching the surf when Fenton burst through the French doors to the deck.
Jack! Volpe's gone!
I thought you were doing 10-minute checks. The doors were double locked.
I was, Jack, I swear. He can't be gone more than a few minutes.
Fortunately, Pauline and I were dressed by now. We followed Fenton out onto the beach. We looked up and down the shoreline. Nothing. No Volpe. He would have headed west toward the Blakely place. It's the only way that makes sense, I said. The three of us sprinted toward the garage and Pauline's car. With Pauline driving, we raced down the long dirt driveway, then turned left toward town. This can't end like this, I said. Pauline, who was already going faster than I would have, put the pedal to the floor. It was a little before 2 a.m. and the road was empty. After half a mile, she took a hard left toward Franklin Cove. Pull over here, I told her. The shoreline is just over that dune. Either we've beaten him here or we're fucked. We jumped out and clambered hand over hand to the top of the dune. My heart was pounding as we topped the crest. We were too late. Volpe was already 100 yards past us, chugging through the sand toward a cluster of big houses at the bend. We took after him anyway, and quickly began closing the gap, but Volpe, who had just noticed us, was running for his life, and we weren't going to catch him before he got to the first house. As I struggled through the sand, a gun went off behind me. Fenton and I turned to see Pauline with her Smith and Wesson held out in front of her. Then she fired again at Volpe. The second bullet must have barely missed him. He stopped in his tracks and raised his hands.
Don't shoot!
We kept running. Fenton got there first.
He lowered his shoulder and 240 pounds into Volpe's chest, sending him sprawling onto his back. In a second we were on him, all anger and frustration of the past year pouring into our punches.
"That's enough," said Pauline. "Stop it!"
But Fenton wasn't through. He grabbed a fistful of sand and shoved it into Volpe's mouth. Volpe gasped for breath, spat and stuttered out a few words. Now I grabbed a handful and pushed it in.
"What happened to Peter?"
I shouted in his face.
"You were there, right, Frank? What happened?"
He was still spitting out sand and gasping.
"No, no,"
he managed.
"Frank, I just want to hear the truth. It doesn't matter what you tell us out here. Nobody will know but us."
Volpe shook his head, and Fenton pushed another handful of sand into his mouth. More gasping and spitting and choking followed. I was almost feeling sorry for him. This time we gave him a minute to get to his feet, breathe, and focus. Fenton couldn't leave him alone, though.
"Now you know how I felt when I got a visit from your friend. He tried to drown me. I couldn't breathe. I was spitting up salt water. How's the sand taste, Frank? Want some more?"
Volpe held both hands in front of his face. He was still choking, trying to clear his mouth.
"Yeah. Neubauer had his goons kill your brother. I still don't know why. I wasn't there, Jack. How could you think that? Christ, I liked Peter."
Jesus. It felt good to hear that. To finally get the truth out. Just to hear it.
"That's all I wanted, Frank. The truth. Stop blubbering, you piece of shit."
But Volpe wasn't finished.
"You still don't have anything on him. Neubauer's too smart for you, Jack."
I hit him with a short right hand, definitely the best punch of my life, and he went face first into the sand.
"I owed you that, you bastard."
Fenton put his hand on the back of Volpe's head and ground his face in the sand.
"Me too."
At least I knew the truth. That was something. We dragged Volpe's sorry ass to Pauline's car and brought him back to the house.
Chapter 99.
A few hours later, after Pauline, Molly, and I made eggs and coffee for the group, we all filed back into the courtroom. I wasn't feeling too chipper, but then the adrenaline kicked in, and I was okay. After Macklin smacked his gavel and called the room to order, Montrose rose and launched into another of his pompous speeches, something he must have been working on all night. I objected, and Mac called the two of us to the bench.
"You know better than this," he said to Montrose. "You should be testifying to the facts, not philosophizing or whatever the hell it is that you're doing. You either, Jack. But because of the other restrictions put on you, Mr. Montrose, and in the interest of fairness and getting at the truth, you go right ahead and make your speeches. Just keep 'em short, for God's sake. I'm not getting any younger."